episode was recorded in May. Imagine that, the beginning of the pandemic and before the murder of George Floyd. We got to interview an ACLU attorney who works with police misconduct and racial discrimination. And the following conversation discusses events pre the Black Lives Matter movement. We weren't able to post this episode when we planned because of, well, so much, you can imagine. But our time with Michael was so incredible, we still wanted to share it with you. If you're interested in going to law school, or what the ACLU does, or police accountability, detention centers, or just need a little bit of inspiration for how to get involved, keep listening. Hello, everyone, and welcome back to Activist in Progress, a podcast for the civically challenged. My name is Alexis Plazzolo, and I'm here with my co-hosts, Olivia Michael, Divya Bhatia, and Ray Longschlager. Divya, who do we have here with us today?
So we're super happy to have ACLU attorney Michael Perloff here with us today. We were able to touch base a few weeks ago and learn all about his journey to law, the work he does with police accountability, and why and how civil rights issues have inspired him to be an activist in his own right. So Michael, thank you so much for taking the time to speak with us today. And what do you want us to call you?
Michael is great. Thank you, Divya. And I'm really so excited to be here. I think this is such a great podcast, and I'm so excited you started and to be part of the first season. So it's really exciting.
Thank you again, Michael, for being here. As college students, still activists in progress, it seems like there are so many roads that we can choose to contribute to these issues. So we were just wondering if you would mind sharing a little about your journey from undergrad to working at the ACLU.
Sure. So, you know, I remember being in college and being really like mixed up and uncertain about how to figure out what type of social issue I should work on, because there seemed like there were so many problems we faced as a society, and it seemed like everyone who I knew who was doing some sort of public interest work had this like incredible story where they started working on like, you know, saving this cause since they were like two, and it was like, how could I possibly figure this out, and how could I possibly have a defined role? And, you know, a friend of mine told me that when you think about what type of work you want to do if you're in the public service domain, you really should try to find the things that move you as an individual. And that advice stuck with me right around the time I got to law school, because at that moment, we saw this uprising of community activists in response to police violence in the country. And I don't want to suggest that that was new, but there was, I think, more attention to those protests and those movements and more organizing perhaps on a national scale around 2014 with the murder of Eric Garner, Michael Brown, and then a slew of other cases that received attention. And seeing those incidents, I think really made clear to me how so many Americans have just a completely different relationship with law enforcement than I did, you know, as a white person growing up in the suburbs. And that really made me think about how there are all these values that we have in terms of celebrating what we think about this country and what the country stands for, and how those are frequently not realized in just profoundly egregious ways. And so I went to law school. I was in law school. I worked on some of these issues. I became more involved. And I spent a year working for a judge. And then I got and came to my current position at the ACLU of DC, working on these issues. And I really don't think there's a better place than the ACLU and its affiliated organizations to do these issues. Although that's not so there aren't a lot of great organizations, but I just have such admiration for its history. And so I was really, really excited to be a part of that. And I've been really excited to be a part of that since I've been there.
So we wanted to know more about the work that you do with prisons and detention centers, specifically now that we're in the pandemic. So could you tell us more about how your work with these groups has shifted or been affected by the pandemic?
Thanks, Alexis. Yeah, you know, it's interesting. My office did not do a lot of prison work. The ACLU nationally has a special prison project, and then the COVID-19 crisis started, and it just totally upended our priorities because of the absolute humanitarian crisis present at the DC jail and at other detention facilities in the District of Columbia. You know, there have been problems getting just basic things like telephone access and showers, like literal showers for people who have the virus, people going days without getting to shower in the jail. And so these sorts of conditions require intervention. And so we've asked the court to intervene. And so far, in general, it has. And it's issued orders that have required there to be reforms, and we're hoping to continue and expand upon those orders across the board over the next couple of weeks. We hear across the country about incidences of violence against inmates who are doing very little wrong. I remember when I was in law school, I represented a person in a disciplinary hearing who was sent to solitary confinement based on charges that had never actually been adjudicated in terms of an internal prison discipline violation. So these institutions, in the best of times, are failing to live up to the sorts of standards of decency that I think we expect, even for people who have committed a wrong in their lives. And now, in this moment of absolute crisis, as usual, I think the most marginalized members of our society, prisoners, are not receiving the sort of prioritization that they need, and being kept in facilities that not only are not necessarily going to get the resources to care for them, but aren't really set up to be able to be places that can protect people from the spread of a threat like COVID-19.
So I want to go back to kind of your focus of your work a little bit more around police brutality. And so I'm curious, now that things have kind of shifted to looking at prisons and detention centers maybe a little bit more, do you see like overlap between your work around police brutality and then now looking at kind of like the institution of prisons and the criminal justice system as a whole?
Right. Yeah. I think there's definitely an overlap. You know, it's interesting. Like, the thing about the criminal justice system is that it's kind of like, it's like wading into a pool. Like, you take a step, you're like, oh, that's kind of cold. But you're like, oh, you know, I'll take a step further and it'll get a little warmer. But each step you take, it actually gets colder. And it's really remarkable. The more you dig in, the more horrors you find. So, you know, is there a relationship between police misconduct and prisons? Absolutely. And I think you can look at that in a lot of different ways. You know, one way there's a relationship is that in a lot of instances, it's police misconduct that leads people to prison. So there have been high profile cases of officers planting evidence, you know, lying on the stand, but it's not even necessarily things as egregious as that. It can just be discretionary choices by officers. The decision to target one part of the community for surveillance, usually lower income communities, communities of color, and not others. And that means that the people who are going to be going into the prison system are going to be different than necessarily the people who are committing the most amount of crime. There's this idea that we should do, you know, whatever is necessary to keep us safe from people who society deems bad, you know, and that definition of bad, you know, is kind of, I think, concerning in a lot of instances, but that idea of doing whatever is necessary to keep us safe is also equally harmful. You know, if we're always going to lock someone up if they pose even the smallest threat, if one minor mistake justifies, you know, harsh treatment, then that's a decision that can justify not only the decision to put someone in prison, it can justify the decision for officers to respond with violence when they feel even a little bit threatened, or the decision to put someone in solitary confinement when they're locked up. So I think that, you know, one of the things that's been so empowering about the Black Lives Matter movements and other movements is reminding people that while obviously safety is important, there are other important values too. And the communities that are affected by the choices of what we define as bad and what we determine for what we need to do to keep people safe, those communities need to have a voice in shaping the balance between those values, the balance that exists in terms of how we police, where we police, who we police, and what happens to people who have been arrested, how we respond to injustice in the form of violence. And I think that we have started to see a reassessment across the board, but that determination that safety necessitates harm is the root problem of so much of our institutional failures.
So I know when we touched base a couple of weeks ago, we got to hear about some of the cases with police accountability that you've been working on. Would you mind sharing a little bit about those cases? What's happening with sexual misconduct in DC with the police there?
Yeah, thanks, Divya. We have seen a really disturbing pattern in the way that people are policed in the District of Columbia, particularly men of color from lower income communities. What we've seen is that those individuals are, you know, stopped disproportionately. And whether they're searched, and when they're searched in the course of what are kind of incidents that maybe constitute a field search or a frisk, officers are probing people's anuses and groin areas in very aggressive ways. In the time that I've worked at the ACLU of DC, I've spoken with four men who have had this happen to them. I know that we filed a case for a fifth individual a little bit before I started. And what is so horrifying about these incidents for me is just the way that the feeling that someone experiences when they're violated in that way lingers well beyond the time that it happens. So in the conversations I've had with people, what struck me is the way that individuals often use the same language to describe what happened. These folks will say they felt that their masculinity was taken from them. They feel that they have been deprived of a level of power, and they feel deeply ashamed of the fact that people in their community will mock them for this, that they have to come forward and talk about this, that they have to relive this. It affects them in their relationships with family, in their work, in their just everyday ability to enter society. And so, you know, I think that I haven't done work in my career with survivors of sexual assault in the non-policing context. And I don't know what those conversations are like. But one thing I think that is really particularly harmful about these incidents is that it's not just the egregious violation, but also the fact that the person who did this is someone who works for the government, who has a gun, who has authority to, do what they need to do in a lot of cases to quote unquote keep communities safe. And on top of that, is the person who you're supposed to rely on when you have a problem. And I think all of those things make for a particularly lonely, devastating injury. We have called repeatedly for the District of Columbia's Metropolitan Police Department to take systemic action in response to this. We haven't gotten it. There have been individual officers disciplined, but even when a retired sergeant said that he trained officers to go up in the crotch when they conduct searches, we didn't see the sort of structural reform that we think is necessary to make sure these sorts of things don't happen in the future. So we're going to continue to advocate for that, because no one should have to endure a sexual assault just for being on the street.
Yeah, thank you for speaking to that. So you mentioned that, you know, the ACLU has taken steps to try to get that kind of structural reform, but it really like hasn't happened. And so I was just wondering, like, do you have any sense of like why these changes are maybe so slow coming, or like what, you know, you think could happen to like further expedite the process?
Yeah, right. That is a good question. And I, you know, next time you should have the police chief on, and maybe he'd give more clarifying responses. I think that like a lot of police chiefs in the country, the one of DC, Chief Newsham, looks at these sorts of problems as being about, you know, one or two bad apples, you know, and if you just, you know, get rid of one or two officers, then, you know, it'll be okay. But what I think you see from the ways that these injustices, and we talk about, you know, how the problems of the criminal justice system literally are throughout the system, right? Means that there's more going on here than one or two people getting the wrong ideas. And of course, when you have a retired sergeant saying that's how you train people, you got a pretty good basis for concluding that. So there's, I think, a confusion about how to deal with this. And I think what we really need is for chiefs around the country to look in the mirror and take responsibility for the cultures that they're creating. One of the reasons why police reform is so difficult is that a lot of the decisions are extremely localized. So, you know, it's not like, when you have like, you can pass a law, then Congress can just say, okay, we're going to do these things now. You know, policing is done at the local level, and really it's difficult to make it function without officers having a lot of discretion to make choices. And so that means that you need to have a set of cultures and procedures and rules and trainings that are effective at each locality and are so strong that they can like remain in people's heads when, as officers, are actually going on this ground and doing those individual decision by decision actions. So, you know, I think it makes for a more challenging form of advocacy than maybe other forms, like, you know, but I will say that one of the reasons why I remain really confident that we're going to be able to get change in this area is the strength of the local activists. You know, as a lawyer, we're kind of somewhere, you know, I mean, whether lawyers are activists, you know, and where we fit in is like an interesting question. I think one that different lawyers have different feelings on, but there are people who are community organizers who have been on the ground in the community for decades. And we have incredible people who do that type of work in DC. And I think their ability to raise attention to these issues is what gives me confidence that we're going to get the change, whether it's through legislation or through acquiring more evidence and filing a lawsuit or getting the right people in charge of the police department to make sort of administrative changes necessary to make things better.
Thank you so much for sharing that. I've learned so much from everything that you've talked about today. And we just wanted to wrap up our podcast with a little bit of a lightning round. Right. So we're just going to ask you four quick questions. You can answer them with the first thing that comes to mind or expand on it if you want. But Alexis is going to ask you the first question.
Yes. So our first question is, what is something that you've been doing in quarantine to keep yourself busy?
I have been watching Mad Men, and I had never watched Mad Men before. And like, I will tell you that it unifies people. You know, my sister works with people who are in debt finance, and they love Mad Men. And my colleagues at the ACLU are organizers, and they love Mad Men. And I don't know what else they agree on. So I think it really shows you that that is like a worthwhile like thing that has been done. And I feel very worthwhile for watching it. So that helps.
I try to make myself feel worthwhile with every show that I watch. So like the 1500 that I've watched since quarantine, I actually felt so proud of myself and sad for myself at the same time when I watched like 6 seasons of a show in 5 days. It was really bad.
No shame. No shame. Not during quarantine, you get it up on and out. You can watch as much TV as you want. That's a rule.
Okay. Thank you. Thank you. That came from an attorney. So
yeah.
So our next question for you, Michael, is who is your favorite activist?
Oh man, my favorite activist. I have so much respect for man. Okay. I think of like people like Barbara Jordan, Shirley Chisholm, you know, pioneers, members of Congress whose leadership I really respect. I think of attorneys who have been just incredibly audacious in their advocacy, like some of my colleagues at the ACLU, including my supervisors, Scott Michael and Art Spitzer, who are just, you know, remarkable lawyers and so dedicated to their work. I think of activists in DC like April Goggins, I have to say that I also think of a woman who I met very briefly when I was working on a campaign almost a decade ago, and she kind of a pillar of the Long Island community who had been there for her own long periods of time and really was, I think, a stalwart in terms of bringing people together and fighting for reform in a community that was totally denied attention by major institutions, by politicians. So I guess I have a lot of people who I'd say would inspire me and fit that category. And it's tough to like pick one. So I don't know, maybe, I hope that helps, but that was not lightning. That was like the opposite of lightning. That was, you know, so we'll try that.
Awesome. Your next question is, what do you wish the world talked more about?
One thing I'll say I wish we talked, I'm going to answer this with two things. Maybe this is the problem with lawyers. They always want to give more than one lightning answer, but I'm going to give two answers. The first thing I'd say I wish we talked about more about is I wish we talked more about what I said before about what we do in response to, you know, perceived dangers to our safety. Like I wish we had that framing of the conversation, like how far are you really willing to go to protect your safety? And can we, is that really worth it? Is 1% increase in safety worth a guaranteed reduction in someone's life by forcing them to go into a reduction in someone's quality of life and ability to have a free life by forcing them to jail? So I think that's a really important framing we should have more about. But I also think that what we talk about is less important than how we talk about it. And what I really wish we had is more conversations where we assume that people are coming from places of good faith and people actually come in from places of good faith. And we just were able to look at the same set of facts and, you know, have honest dialogues, people who don't necessarily disagree with us about our fundamental positions and maybe reach some new ways of understanding, and hope that other people do too. So that'd be my hope.
Great. Thank you. And our last question today is kind of a spotlight on the theme of our podcast of being an activist in progress. So how are you an activist in progress?
I think that, so I guess I've kind of dovetailed around it a lot. I think as a lawyer, I am an activist in progress in a couple of different ways. The first is that as lawyers, we are supporting movements, and we can support movements directly by listening to them when they bring forward community concerns and advising them on what their options are, whether this is advising them about their legal options or their legislative options, or representing them in court, as we've done and I've had the opportunity to do. And so I think that's one way that I feel like I'm an activist. I think the second way that we as lawyers can be activists is in playing maybe a little bit more of a general role and identifying areas that may not affect one community in particular, but do affect the space we all have to advocate. And these are things like the rights to protest, government surveillance. You know, there are a lot of great organizers who are working on those issues, but it's also important to have lawyers in that domain, because that's a space where courts have traditionally been open to arguments that I think create more room for people who have unpopular opinions to come forward and make those unpopular opinions reality.
Thank you, Michael. How would you encourage our listeners to learn more about the work you do and the topics that you deal with?
I would say they should go to acludc.org. We've got a lot of resources there, certainly about our work, but I also think there are some great books out there that cover issues of criminal justice and what's going on. Locking Up Our Own is a terrific book. The Collapse of American Criminal Justice, another terrific book. So definitely reading those resources, but I think ultimately, the best way to learn about the problems of criminal justice are to find ways to work with those who are affected by those problems. So the more time people can take to, you know, volunteer with programs that support prisoners, and those may be difficult during COVID, but there are a lot of great institutions out there that provide education to prisoners and give them access to services. There are programs that encourage prisoners to write and allow program called Free Minds, where prisoners write stories and people read them and talk about them with the prisoners. So I think that engaging with people who are affected, learning from their experiences, and from those that education, thinking about how to work with the people who face these problems to build a world that has fewer of them.
Wow, I really love that last line that you said, and appreciate the resources that you gave our listeners too. I think we all would agree that, you know, one of the best ways to really understand an issue better is to make those personal connections and, you know, to get involved with it. So I appreciate you giving us some action steps we can take. And I know, like, I'll personally check it out for sure.
So I just wanted to thank you again for being here with us today. And we hope that our listeners learned a little bit about the challenges that this country is still facing around police misconduct and the work of the ACLU right now to ensure the safety of people in prisons during a pandemic. And so thank you to our listeners for tuning in to another episode of Activist in Progress, and we'll see you next time.